Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for another episode of SLMA Radio. Rotating series of shows, all focusing on the Sales Lead Management Association and the world of sales lead management overall. Today's episode is Data Dump Radio, a show where you can hear top B2B data vendors and buyers discuss the reality of today's data landscape. With our host, Mark Godley, who helps navigate your buying decisions, maybe enjoy a laugh or two along the way. Data Dump is brought to you by Lead Genius. So let's bring in the Lead Genius himself, Mark Godley. Hey, Mark.
Thank you, Paul. Paul is our announcer today for another episode of the Data Dump Show. And I'm pretty excited about our guest today, Rob Kornblum. I have known Rob for a couple of years. Rob, welcome to the call.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Rob and I got to know each other a couple of years ago. Rob, I don't know if you remember this, but our first conversation was you doing a job reference check for someone.
Yeah, that's right. I'm a big believer in reference checks.
And interestingly enough, we hit it off so much. Unexpectedly, we became fast friends and sounding boards for each other in the data space for some number of years. It's been a great relationship.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Besides Rob being a veteran of the data space, he is an entrepreneur. He's been a venture capitalist, and he's joining us today as an author, having written now two books that I think are very appropriate for those of us who spend time in the startup space. Rob, tell us about the two books you've written.
The first book, called Never Too Late to Start Up, is about midlife entrepreneurship. And I don't define what midlife means, but it's very pointedly don't define that. But it's really trying to take a look at how to be an entrepreneur, particularly for the first time, when you have all the what I'll call encumbrances of life, spouse, kids, mortgage, calls on your time, all that stuff as constraints, but also bringing a bunch of assets to the table, both life experience and work experience and thoughts and ideas about what could be good companies and good products, a network and a set of experiences around best practices in different functions. How do you combine all that into being a successful entrepreneur? And then the second book called Entrepreneur Rocket Fuel is about building great cultures and hiring in startups and high growth companies. And it really came from the first one. One of the things that I thought was really interesting when I interviewed a bunch of CEOs for the first book and founders was they talked a lot about culture and in particular how they built a culture that was unique to their place in life. And so I just thought that was a really interesting idea and wanted to write it starts with a blog post and then I kind of say, wait, that could be something more than that. So this book really built out of the first and it also built on my experience as a venture capitalist, realizing how important team was to the success of startups and also my experience as an entrepreneur, just appreciating how hard it is to hire.
Your thesis, it sounds like, of this book is that culture, hiring, people are an essential ingredient to the success or failure of startups. Is that true?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say it's the successful ingredient. One of the things that I have said that certainly people have disagreed with is that I think the team is even more important than product. And
wow.
And certainly, again, people disagree with that, but you'll often see instances where a great team will figure out a new product, a new market, a new business model. And those we now classically call pivots, as one friend of mine said, we used to call that dodging and weaving. But whatever the term, you see great teams that are able to navigate those kinds of challenges and also able to navigate the challenges of scaling. And you often don't see the reverse of that. Like I said, it's a controversial statement, and certainly you could find lots of examples to counter it. But I think ultimately, great companies are built around that combination of product, market, and team. And you really can't build a great company without all of those.
Well, that resonates with me. I certainly have seen it in my own trials and tribulations. And a good example might be just earlier this month. It looks like Slack filed for its IPO. And many people probably know that tale of Butterfield selling, I think it was Flickr, way early, starting a gaming company that was failing, but they had this little communication channel behind the scenes that was seemingly working, tried to give money back to the VCs. And they said, keep it and do something with it. and he pivoted, what'd you call it? Something in weaving, bobbing and weaving?
Bobbing and weaving, yeah, dodging and weaving, right, either way.
Yeah, and now we have one of the most successful unicorns because of that, because of the people. The product was wrong, but the people figured it out. So
yeah,
there's
absolutely.
At least one data point.
And there's plenty of other great examples. Yeah, that's a fantastic one. Twitter was a pretty famous one. Groupon started out in a completely different market. And, you know, it's easy to...
What's the Twitter story, Rob? I don't know that.
Twitter was a podcast platform that they were trying to build and which they kind of struggled with. And then a company was called Odeo. They struggled with that. And then when Apple introduced some native podcasting with one of the more recent or at the time more recent versions of their platform on the iPhone, they were sure that it was going to be death for the company. And they had this little idea around, you know, micro communication. So they carved out a thing inside Odeo first and then ultimately set up a separate company.
Excellent. So based on the interviews you did for CEOs for Entrepreneur Rocket Fuel, what's the most unexpected thing you learned from those discussions for the second book?
Yeah, I think the thing that surprised me the most was I had always, both as a VC and as an entrepreneur, felt like culture and culture fit were critical elements of building a team, particularly early stage. And what I found was that a really strong kind of bimodal feeling about hiring for culture among startup CEOs. And the people that I spoke with for the most part for this book were people who have been very, very successful, have built multi-hundred million, if not billion-dollar companies, either on this current iteration of their business or, you know, had done so in the past and they were on their second time around. And that bimodal feeling was really interesting for me. A set of folk who agreed with that where I had come from, which is, yes, absolutely, hiring for culture is super important. And then another set who felt like that culture fit and that construct produces a really strong bias, can produce a really strong bias in hiring. And it's part of the reason why we have such issues around diversity in, you know, in high tech, is because people fall back on a word like fit. When it's a group of 20-somethings who's interviewing a 50-something and they say, oh, that person doesn't fit, or a group of men who interview a woman, that person doesn't fit. And so eliminating that sense of what fit is, I think, is among this group of founders really important. And they fall back on really being very values-centric, articulating their values and hiring for values, but not trying to worry about what fit is because it's one of those things that they can't define. And so they do look for people who share their values, but they don't try to shoehorn in, you know, culture fit again, because very often it's loosely defined and yields that lack of diversity.
Tell me about your perspective of great culture and what success means. And this is going to end up being a two-part question, but the first part of it is the examples of Netflix and Amazon, both of which have had exposés of sorts in the last couple of years on how those internal environments are really, really, really challenging. And to me, that means the culture might not be ideal. Maybe I'm defining it wrong. However, can you find two companies that have been more successful, at least defined by stock price, market capitalization, and market dominance? So how does success and culture play hand in hand?
I think it comes back a little bit to what my own opinions about what culture is. So I view company culture as being both top-down driven and bottom-up driven. I don't think that executives can define it, but I also don't think that without some definition, then, you know, you end up with it just being far too loose. And so I think that you do try to define, as a founder and an executive, you do try to define the parameters that you think are important, but you also need to appreciate that culture grows from within. You know, it's a living organism. You know, a smart CEO said to me, "Culture is an output, not an input." I'm joking. That was you, Mark. So
I thought so.
Yeah. So
brilliant comment.
Yeah, it was a fantastic comment. I love it. I actually use it when I tweet out about my book. So back to those two examples. I think it's really interesting that yes, those have had exposés, but also that they're really, really well defined cultures. I mean, Patty McCord, who was one of the early executives at Netflix, has done glowing interviews about building the Netflix culture. And they were one of the first companies that published a culture deck about what their culture is. You know, yes, I think in some ways those can be challenging places, but I also think they're incredibly well defined as to who's going to work well there. In the case of Netflix, they were really, really interested in people who resonated with their two big talking points around freedom and responsibility. In the case of Amazon, they similarly, responsibility is really important. They'll give, you know, fresh college grads, you know, 6 and 7 figure budgets to, you know, to work with and tons of freedom to get the job done. And so there are people who I think resonate with that and people who don't. One of the things that McCord said that I really thought was really interesting was that humans hate being lied to and hate being spun. And so part of what, in my opinion, is a bad culture, it's one in which you say one thing and do another. And I think for both Netflix and Amazon, I don't think that's the case. I think whatever those challenges are, I think if you do any bit of research, you know what they are when you go in. And so get there and it doesn't suit you, you just didn't do a lot of research, quite honestly.
I think for a long time, I mistook the concept of a good culture, meaning a fun place to work, a fun place to be. I want you to comment on that after a quick break here, Rob. We're going to go have somebody pay for today's broadcast with a commercial break. We'll be back in 2 seconds and let's riff on that concept a little bit more. And then let's get into your data background. I think most people coming to this call want to hear a little bit about that because you've got a fascinating background there.
Sure.
So we'll be back on the other side of the break.
How well do you know your total addressable market? Yeah, that's what we're talking about, your total addressable market. What are the most profitable micro segments of your audience? And who are all the decision makers at your ideal accounts? That's what we're referring to. Well, if you don't know, Lead Genius can help you figure it out. Lead Genius helps business-to-business enterprise companies such as Google, eBay, and Square power their go-to-market strategies. They can do the same for you. They have the highest quality contact and account data available anywhere. How? Well, Lead Genius verifies every single data point with a unique combination of real human researchers and, of course, machine learning. Quality is assured, results are guaranteed, and accuracy is 100%. Guaranteed, really. See for yourself why enterprise marketing and sales leaders trust Lead Genius. Find out more at their website, leadgenius.com, and figure out what is your total addressable market today. Think about it. Lead Genius can help you figure it out. leadgenius.com. All right, let's pick it back up with the second half of our interview.
And welcome back to the second half of the Data Dump. Today we're with Rob Kornblum, a data veteran and author of 2 books, one being Never Too Late to Start Up, and the current one we're talking about, Entrepreneur Rocket Fuel, which speaks mostly about culture. So Rob, speak a little bit about that comment I made on the other side of the break, specifically that culture means a fun place to be. Is that culture or was I mistaken?
I don't think that's culture. You know, I think culture is a set of behaviors and a set of expectations of each other. And those behaviors, it's important that executives and founders model those behaviors. As I said, it's one thing when you put the posters up on the wall, but if you don't live that, then, you know, everybody kind of scratches their head and gets a little disillusioned. But I don't think that happiness is necessarily a critical element of a good culture. Certainly, if people are unhappy regularly, then that probably is a tell that they're not, you know, a good fit for that culture. But people who are striving, who have been given a set of responsibility, who are being respected, and one of the ways you show respect to people is by setting tough goals and explaining to them where they're meeting their goals and not, that doesn't always produce happiness. But it does produce growth, and I think people value that. And it does produce, you know, a sense of kind of purpose in terms of doing work that contributes, you know, to the overall company. So even places that can be challenging, and you mentioned two, and there's plenty of others, tech world, you know, I think as long as people are shown respect and given the opportunity to grow, that happiness to me is less something we should all be striving for and more about, is the company growing? Are my people growing? Are they respected? Do they respect each other? Do they work well with customers? I think, you know, that's a big part of it. Do they respect customers? They treat customers properly. And that set of things, I think, ends up being far more important than true, you know, happiness or, you know, that kind of thing.
Rob, I think you just nailed that. That 2-minute answer, I think, is the essence of what I strive for in helping run startups. So thank you for that insight. And you've helped me along in my journey in understanding how to build a good culture.
Sure,
because
yeah.
That was such a fantastic answer, let's pivot ourselves a little bit, this conversation, to the discussion of your background, specifically around data and funding. And right now, we're at an incredibly interesting time in the B2B data space, given the consolidation that's been going on. What's your take on what's really happening here?
Quickly, so I was the head of corporate development for Avention, which was the old OneSource platform. We were both, we were private equity owned by a large PE fund. And so we were both a buyer and a seller at different points in time. We were a buyer pretty regularly, certainly looking at a lot of things, and then ultimately a seller in that we sold the business to D&B about 2 years ago. And so I think consolidation is pretty normal in these kinds of markets, and especially I think in markets where there has been a lot of innovation you know, you see a lot of really interesting companies and startups and niches. But it becomes hard for the buyer, for the corporate data buyer, to kind of figure out what they need. And so I think a lot of that consolidation, you know, is helping for the customers to rationalize, you know, what is exactly I need, how does it work together, and it just becomes a little bit of an easier journey, buyer journey for that buyer to, you know, to work with one company or two companies rather than, you know, six or ten.
From a buyer perspective, I can go to one vendor, I can get multiple data sets, depending on my needs, the kind of menu a la carte circumstance. Can you paint a picture where this is not good for a buyer or not good for the industry?
Sure. Yeah, I think if there's two pictures. One is if innovation, you know, is stifled, if somebody buys a larger company buys, you know, something that's innovative and then squashes it, which certainly can happen, or folds it in such a way that it loses its essence. So that's, you know, that can be a negative. And then I think the other is, and we saw some of this, and I'm not sure how much more of it we'll see, where you see large software platform companies acquiring data vendors. And that could be dangerous. Again, I'm not saying it necessarily is, but it could be if the data itself becomes either unavailable on other platforms, becomes a form of lock-in, bias associated with that. I mean, for example, you know, I'll give you the positive example, right? Oracle has been pretty acquisitive in buying companies for both its CRM and marketing automation platforms, but also runs a data exchange. And so to date, all of the companies that they've acquired, and they've spent a lot of money on data companies, have continued to be available broadly, not only for the Oracle pieces of software, but also for people outside the Oracle universe. So, but if you ever see that, you know, starting to flip, or you start to see pricing bias or actual data bias, then I think that would be a bad thing.
Excellent. Going back to your venture capital roots, and I think you call yourself a recovering venture capitalist these days. So talk a little bit about the capital markets. I mean, just let me give you a little bit of lead in from my perspective. Seems like there's a record amounts of money being spent from venture and private equity, but it seems like it's going to smaller, to fewer companies and to later stage entities. Is that what's happening, or is that a good thing, bad thing, or am I only seeing a portion of the market?
I think it is happening, but I don't think it's happening in place of early stage funding. So I think a lot of that growth that's taken place, the growth from, you know, 25 billion of or 30 billion of venture capital deployed, which was what we had coming out of the first bubble bursting. So, the 2001, 2002 timeframe when the NASDAQ collapsed, that was kind of where we were. And now we've grown again to over 100 billion being deployed, which is about where we were during that bubble time. So the 99, 2000, internet bubble. And much of that growth has taken place in late stage financing. And it's really, quite honestly, in many ways, replaced the public offering. You know, when you see a company raise $100 million, $200 million, $300 million at a multi-billion dollar valuation, that didn't used to happen. That used to be an IPO. That used to be a secondary offer.
Yeah, sure.
And so that growth has definitely taken place. And, you know, I think it's a good thing. Certainly, there's a lot of money out there. I think it's challenging because everybody focuses way too much on funding as an outcome rather than as fuel for the car. I like to joke, you know, when you celebrate a funding round, it's a little bit like sending a postcard from a gas station. Like, you know, you don't send the postcard from the gas station. You wait till you get to, you wait till you get to the beach. So wait till you get to the beach.
Oh, good Lord.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah. So I think it's a little silly. I'm not 100% sure why, although listen, if you're a CEO of a private multi-billion dollar private company and you need to raise capital and you can raise $200 million from SoftBank, and you can do that without needing to go public, without needing the scrutiny of the public markets and making quarters, you can provide liquidity to your shareholders and maybe to a degree to, you know, your early employees. You know, that's a pretty good thing. If you can defer that need to go public for, you know, a year or two or more, I can see why people choose that option.
Rob, I'm going to use that gas station postcard analogy with attribution, mind you, in the future, because I'm so irked by those press releases about funding rounds. And Rob, you know, we need more time. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on the show. How
My
can
pleasure.
People reach you, and how can people get the books?
Yeah, absolutely. So the books are available on Amazon, both of them in both Kindle version and paperback. Again, Entrepreneur Rocket Fuel is the second one, and Never Too Late to Start Up is the first. And also, I write pretty prodigiously in terms of, you know, around the web, but also on my own blog. My blog is startlaunchgrow.com. And if people want to reach out to me, they can send me an email. Or they can find my contact information on the, you know, on the blog itself. My email is rob@startlaunchgrow.com.
You've been listening to another episode of SLMA's Data Dump. Brought to the good folks at Lead Genius. Right here in the Funnel Radio Network for at-work listeners like you.